भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Verse number 11. Okay, 11.
Gopya sumishta mani kundala nishka kantiyash.
Gopya sumishta mani kundala nishka kantiyash.
Chitrambara patishika chyuta malya varsha.
Chitrambara patishika chyuta malya
varsha. Chapter 5.
Nandalayam savalaya rajatir vivejur.
Nandalayam savalaya rajatir
vivejur. Vyalola kundala payo dara hara shobha.
Vyalola kundala payo dara hara
shobha. Gopiyak sumishta mani kundala nishka kantiyash. Chitrambarak patishika chyuta malya varsha.
Chitrambarak patishika chyuta malya varsha.
Nandalayam savalaya vajatir vivejur.
Nandalayam savalaya vajatir vivejur.
Vyalola kundalaya Kundala payo darahara shobha.
Vyalola kundala payo darahara
shobha. Gopyaha.
Gopyaha.
The gopis.
The gopis.
Sumrishta.
Sumrishta.
Very dazzling.
Very dazzling.
Mani.
Mani.
Made of jewels.
Made of
jewels. Kundala.
Kundala.
Wearing earrings.
Nishka
kantya,
and having little keys
and lockets hanging from their necks. Chitra ambaraha, dressed with varieties of colored embroidery. Pati, on their way to Yashoda Mayi's house. Shikachyuta
fell
from their hair.
Malya
Varsha, a shower of flower garlands.
Nandalayam,
to the house of Maharaj Nanda. Savolaya, with bangles on their hands.
Rajati,
while going in that costume. Rivejuhu, they looked very, very beautiful. Vyalola, moving.
Kundala,
with earrings.
Payodara,
with breasts.
Hara,
with flower garlands.
Shobha,
who appeared so beautiful. You will not learn from the study of grammar how to write like this. This is not grammar. This is poetry. This is a different art. This Prabhupada is not, first of all, a grammarian. He's a transcendental poet. He should not be judged by just the rules of grammar. Okay, translation and purport. In the ears of the gopis were brilliantly polished jeweled earrings, and from their necks hung metal lockets. Their hands were decorated with bangles. Their dresses were of varied colors. And from their hair, flowers fell onto the street like showers. Thus, while going to the house of Maharaj Nanda, the gopis, their earrings, breasts, and garlands moving, were brilliantly beautiful. Purport. The description of the gopis who are going to the house of Maharaj Nanda to welcome Krishna is especially significant. The gopis were not ordinary women, but expansions of Krishna's pleasure potency, as described in the Brahma Samhita. Ananda chinmaya rasa prapi bhavita bis tabir yoiva nijarupataya kala bih goloka eva nivasatya kilatma bhuto govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami chintamani prakara satma sukalpa viksha laksha viteshu surabir abhipalayantam lakshmi sahasra shata samrama sevyamanam Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Krishna, Govinda, it probably doesn't give a translation, so let me just try to translate. I worship that Govinda, the original personality of Godhead, the soul of all beings, Akilatma Bhuto, who is residing primarily in Goloka, along with the expansions of his pleasure potency. These expansions, who are non-different from his original pleasure potency, Srimati Radharani, and who expand as the various aspects of her infinite potencies, they're the companions of Krishna in Goloka. And then I worship that same Govinda who served with great attention and care by hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune as he tends the cows, the Surabhi cows, in transcendental houses, palaces, studded with Chintamani stones, among the millions of desire trees. Prabhupada continues, Krishna is always worshipped by the gopis wherever he goes. Therefore, Krishna is so vividly described in Srimad Bhagavatam, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has also described Krishna in this way. Ramya kachir upasana vajavaru vargina ya kolpita. All these gopis were going to offer Krishna their presentations, because the gopis are eternal associates of the Lord. Now the gopis were more jubilant because of the news of Krishna's appearance in Vrindavan. We have to try to understand the transcendental nature of Krishna's birth and his activities. One way that will help us is to understand something about the birth and activities of his devotees. Because Krishna is the supreme absolute personality of Godhead, it is impossible to fully comprehend him. Yato vacho nivartante apapya manasasaha. This is the statement of the Upanishad. Words cease. They give up trying to describe this absolute truth. They just cannot do it. They give up. Normally, any human language, whether it's the language of the Karnataka Brahmanas or the language of the headhunters in Borneo, any human language manages to find a way to say everything that everybody is thinking about and everybody wants to say. Usually their language can express it somehow or other. Sometimes we just don't know what to say. We just say thingamabob or this thing or that thing. We don't know exactly the word, but we manage somehow to express. Language usually is adequate to express meaning. And the Eskimos, they have 30 different words for snow. Yeah. And in Karnataka, they have probably a few dozen words for rice. Yeah. According to what the particular individual culture requires, the language provides. But there's a limit. There are things that are just beyond the limit of language to express. There's a limit beyond which words just give up. So the Upanishad is saying, Ito vacho nivartante. Your Eskimo language may be able to describe the 30 different kinds of snow. But can you describe the infinite variety found in the personality of Godhead with your language? Sanskrit language is the best medium for describing the personality of Godhead. And vernacular languages have been adapted to that purpose also. Great acharyas, great devotees are able to use imperfect instruments very expertly and make the best use of them. Great pundits have tried to express the absolute truth, great scholars, rishis, in the Sanskrit language. Then other languages, which are less perfect and less capable of describing everything about transcendence, more mundane languages and imperfect languages, the modern languages of this world, have also been employed by great devotees to describe the absolute truth, and they've been very successful in these endeavors. In medieval times, the Sri Vaishnava Acharyas adapted the Tamil language, and they promoted that they have Ubhaya Vedanta, that they're teaching the philosophy of Vedanta both in Sanskrit and in Tamil. And they have their Dravida Veda, the Tiruvayamoli, or the ecstatic poems of the Alwars written in Tamil. That is their Tamil Veda. And so they are presenting the absolute truth, and they're doing it successfully in vernacular language. And then the Acharyas in our Gaudiya Sampradaya, we also have our Ubhaya Vedanta, but we don't use Tamil, we use Bengali. And Narottam Das Thakur, other great devotees of Lord Chaitanya, many of them were Kavirajas. Great poets, Sanskrit poets. Krishnas Kaviraj was also a great Sanskrit poet. His Govinda Lilamrita is a very excellent piece of Sanskrit literature. It was not written by an ordinary man, an ordinary poet. But he also wrote the Chaitanya Charitamrita in the vernacular Bengali, describing the absolute truth in ordinary language. This takes a very most expert author to use an imperfect tool, a mundane language, to describe what normally is described only in pure language. Narottam Das Thakur wrote very simple songs in a very simple Bengali style. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, following in his footsteps, his follower, declared that the songs of Narottam Das Thakur are as good as the Vedas. And he composed a Sanskrit commentary on the, what is it? Not Partana, the other book. Prema Bhakti Chandrika. Sanskrit commentary on Bengali songs by Vishwanath Chakrabarty, just to honor the greatness of the poetry of Narottam Das Thakur. And then Srila Prabhupada has given us his Bhaktivedanta purports in the English language and his translations of the Gita and Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita in English. English was developed among barbarians. You know, in English you'll find 40 different words for meat, for cow's flesh. Yeah. Because this is the culture it developed in. You know, how to kill and slaughter, we have plenty of words for that. And you know, various obscenities and words describing violence, that we have plenty of in our language. Prabhupada adapted that very imperfect tool and expressed the absolute truth in such a way that people all over the world could understand. You can say, well, English is not fit. When you translate the Bhagavatam into English, it is not the same thing. You can say that, but the test is, palena parichiyate, judged by the results, that lakhs of people have become serious devotees of Krishna by reading that translation. Even by reading translations of that translation. And some of those translations of that translation are not very good. The books that were first distributed in Russia, before there was a, BBT was able to get any books in there, there were some unusual books that were being passed around that, hardly represented Prabhupada properly in Russian. The first books that ever got into Russia. But devotees read them and became devotees. Prabhupada's potency, through a very imperfect translation, Prabhupada's potency came through anyway. A translation of a translation. So this is the potency of a great devotee, a great Vaishnav communicator, that he can use imperfect means to accomplish a perfect end and to express the absolute truth in ordinary language. Shukadeva Goswami, going back 5,000 years and going back to the Sanskrit language, has described the transcendental activities of Krishna, the same activities that he performs in Goloka, he exhibited on the earth 5,000 years ago. He did accept a kind of limitation on himself by entering the realm of time and space. Sri Jiva Goswami in the Bhakti Sandarbha explains about the difference between Krishna's prakrita and aprakrita lila, his visible and or public pastimes, and his invisible secret pastimes. Krishna's aprakrita lila are not different from his original lilas in Goloka. And so are his manifest pastimes. But the manifest pastimes, as we see them with our eyes, seem to be within the limitations of time and space. As they are described by Shukadeva Goswami, one event occurs after another. Krishna is in one place at a time. He's talking to one devotee at a time. Krishna, Shukadeva does not confuse us by describing Krishna taking birth simultaneously, both in Gokula and Mathura. Although in Gopal Champu, Jiva Goswami does describe that. And we do accept that as fact. But Shukadeva Goswami spared us the complications. He described Krishna being in one place at a time. And it is Prakriti Lila that is the fact. That Krishna enters time and space voluntarily. And in material time and space, one person is usually in one place at a time. He does one thing at a time. And time goes straight forward at a regular pace. You can't backtrack and do something over again, or live something over again in material time. Time goes forward and you can't stop it. Krishna voluntarily accepts that limitation. the limitations of time and space, whereas in the spiritual realm there are no such limitations. If you like a pastime, you can do it over again. You can kill Kamsa every day, over and over again. It's described in the Brihadbhagavatamrita, such things going on. Kamsa, Arjuna comes and takes Krishna away, Krishna goes to Mathura, kills Kamsa and comes back again, and everybody forgets it happened, and 2 days later it happens all over again. Akura comes again, and Krishna goes and kills Kamsa again. That's spiritual time. It's flexible. The material time is rigid, and it only goes in one direction. Krishna voluntarily enters that realm, and he only does one thing at a time. Whereas on the Aprakrita Lila, Krishna can serve all his devotees simultaneously. In the Prakrita Lila, the public pastimes that Krishna manifested for 125 years at the beginning of, just before the beginning of Kali Yuga, devotees had to wait their turn for their opportunity to participate in particular pastimes. Krishna only did one thing at a time. That's how Shukadeva describes. He's describing the public pastimes, manifest pastimes. But still, those pastimes are non-different. We just see them in a limited way. We're only looking at one side. Like you're looking at a tree only from the front. But you know the tree is not flat. You know that there's something on the back side. You just don't see it. You're only looking on one side. That doesn't mean the tree is not three-dimensional, but your vision is only two-dimensional. So we're getting a two-dimensional snapshot when we're looking at Krishna's visible pastimes. A limited picture of what Krishna is doing. But even that limited picture is pure transcendence, and it is non-different. It's only our vision is limited. So the same devotees, the same pleasure potencies of Krishna, of Goloka, are accompanying him in his appearance on this earth, in his public appearance also, as described by Shukadeva in the 10th canto. We have to try to understand the transcendental nature of these activities. Janma karma cha me divyam eva mioveti tatvataha chatva deham punar janma naiti mameti sarjana. This is key to perfection, and it is very easy. We don't have to accomplish anything spectacular. We just have to understand the special nature of Krishna's birth and activities. Then we're liberated. We don't come back again to birth in this material world, but we go to Krishna. By understanding about Krishna's devotees, that makes it easier to understand the transcendental nature of Krishna and his activities. Krishna's God. He's infinite. Even when you just look at a two-dimensional cross-section of Krishna's manifest pastimes, even that is too much for anybody to comprehend. God is incomprehensible. He's too much for anybody to comprehend. That is one way that the Vaishnavacharyas explain the Upanishadic statement. Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha. Words give up. They cannot manage to properly describe the absolute truth. Aprapya manasasaha. Neither is he attainable by mental exercise. Mentally and verbally he cannot be comprehended. The impersonalists take it to mean that no words can say anything about the absolute truth properly. They can only vaguely point in his direction by what we call Lakshana Vritti. But then, that means, according to the impersonalists, the Vedas don't describe the absolute truth. They sometimes pick out the Mahavakyas, the few statements that supposedly do actually describe the pure absolute truth. But if you analyze those statements, they're just as dualistic as the ones that the impersonalists reject. Satyam Gyanam Anantam Brahma is supposed to be one of those Mahavakyas from the Taittiriya Upanishad. The absolute truth is just, it's absolute truth, eternal and unlimited. Okay, that's impersonal enough, they think. But those are qualities. Your impersonal absolute truth isn't supposed to have any distinct, separable qualities. Satyam as opposed to asatyam. Anantam as opposed to sanantam, having an end. So you're saying, even if you're saying it negatively, you're assigning dualistic qualities to the absolute truth. According to your own criterion, this is not an acceptable description of the absolute truth. What you're describing is duality. If you call something real, knowledge, eternal and unlimited, you're describing something in dualistic terms. The absolute truth must be beyond that description. You haven't adequately described the absolute truth. So, therefore, according to the interpretation, the criterion of the impersonalist, the Vedas fail to say anything really about the absolute truth. Even the so-called Mahavakyas of the Upanishads. Adrishatadi gunako dharmoktehi, one aphorism of the Vedanta. Vyasadeva is saying that don't think that you've described the absolute truth by keeping all your descriptions negative. He's not this, he's not that, 1880. Ananta, he's not limited. But even the negative qualities are still qualities, Vyasadeva is arguing. Adrishatva, invisibility. So you say he's invisible. That's not, you may claim that's not a quality, but it is a quality. It's a power to be invisible. If you exist, if you don't exist, there's no difficulty being invisible. You know, the rabbit spawn in this room is invisible. The son of a barren woman who's sitting in this room is invisible because he doesn't exist. The unborn enemy of Yudhishthira doesn't exist. So no problem being invisible if you don't exist. But if you do exist, to be invisible is quite a trick. You know, you're alive, you weigh 80 kilos, you breathe and you talk and somehow you have a power by which you can sit in the room and be invisible. You know, that means you have a potency. This is a definite quality. You may describe it negatively, but it's an actual quality. This is Vyasadeva's argument. The saying that the absolute truth is ananta, he's got no limits. Well, if he didn't exist, okay, he wouldn't have any limits. But he exists, and he manages not to have any limits. That's a great power, a potency. It's a quality. You can't tell me that it's not a description of a quality. So the Vedas are not describing an impersonal truth. The absolute truth is full of qualities, all those vicious qualities. So how are we going to understand this statement that words give up, they fail to describe him, and the mind also cannot apprehend him? What does that mean then? We can't say that the Upanishads are wrong or that they're lying. The statement must be understood in such a way that it's correct. So the Vaishnavacharyas give two explanations. One is that the words of an ordinary materialistic person cannot begin to describe the absolute truth. Only the words of a pure devotee can describe the personality of Godhead. And only the mind of a devotee can begin to understand that personality of Godhead. That's first interpretation given by the Vaishnavacharyas. Second, even the best devotee, even Lord Brahma, even the more purest devotees cannot understand everything about Krishna. Nor can they say everything. Shesho dunapi adyavastiti nasiparam. With thousands of his mouths, Ananda Shesha is chanting the glories of Lord Narayana, since the beginning of creation, and he can never reach the end of it. No one, even Vyasadeva or any great sage, can say everything about the Absolute Truth, the personality of Godhead. So he cannot be described or understood completely by anybody. This is the proper explanation of that statement, that words fail to describe and the mind cannot understand. So Krishna's wonderful qualities and all the wonderful things he did, even just in his visible pastimes on this earth, which you can say are in a way finite. He was here for 125 years, he wasn't here forever. He couldn't have done an infinite number of things, he must have done a finite number of things. But even that, nobody can fully describe. What Krishna does in 5 minutes, nobody could, in his whole lifetime, could adequately describe. Shukadeva Goswami still has managed to describe Krishna's leelas in a compact version. Described in such a way, bhajate tadrishi prida yakshrutva tatparobhavet. By, this is Shukadeva's statement, Krishna displays such wonderful activities in such a way, and such wonderful activities, that someone who simply hears about them will become seriously attracted to him. You don't have to be there in person. You don't have to have seen the pastimes. You just can hear about them, and you can hear about them a long time after the fact. That's enough to become swept off your feet, to have your, what is it? Shukadeva Goswami. Akrishna Cheta Raja Shir Akyana Miradita Man. His mind was Akrishna, pulled away from his interest. And he wasn't interested in something insignificant. We were interested in watching football games on TV and drinking beer. And we were attracted instead, to drink sweet rice and enjoying the kirtans. That wasn't so hard, because it was such an inferior thing that we gave up. It just takes a little intelligence and sensibility to want to give up such inferior things to get such a nice replacement. But Shukadev had the best thing. He had a realization of the Absolute Truth. He was a liberated sage. He gave that up. His mind just dropped his meditation on Brahman because he was attracted away from it, distracted by hearing the pastimes of Krishna from Vyasadeva in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Just by hearing, this is the potency of hearing Krishna's description, pastimes, especially as described by Shukadeva in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. If you're a Gyani, you will not be satisfied. If you're a hardcore Gyani, you will not be satisfied because you want all the information. You will not commit yourself to something unless you know everything about it. But you're never going to know everything about Krishna. Shukadeva doesn't reveal all the facts, all the details. It's not possible in only 18,000 verses. And half of those verses are not directly describing Krishna's pastimes. Ninth canto is almost half the Bhagavatam. Ninth canto is only 4,900 shlokas. Tenth canto is about 4,900 shlokas. Krishna's Leela is described a little bit in other cantos. So, practically only 1/3 or less of the Bhagavatam is directly describing Krishna's own pastimes. The other avatars get description, and then other subjects beside the pastime activities of the Lord take up a lot of the space of the Bhagavatam. It's not possible, practically, to say everything about Krishna's pastimes, to give Agni all the facts, so that he finally decides, okay, now I'm convinced, I'll surrender to Krishna. Agni will not be attracted. Paramahamsanam nirmatsananam satam vidyam atra vastu. What's being told here in the Bhagavatam is meant for the devotees. Nirmatsananam, those who are free from envy. The hardcore impersonalists, the Mayavadis, are envious. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very much against having any association with the Mayavadis, or against giving them any credit for being good about anything. Aparadi hoiva. The Advaitavadis are simply offenders against Krishna. They are envious of him. Other impersonalists may be less harmful. You can put them in the category of Brahmavadis, naive impersonalists, who just don't know better. They should theoretically know about Krishna if they've read the Shastras, if they've read the Puranas, if they've read the Bhagavatam, but without having received the mercy of pure devotees, they remain impersonalists because they have not had the association and not gotten the dust on their feet of pure Vaishnavas. Therefore, they remain naive. They've heard it, but it doesn't sink into their hearts that the Absolute Truth is actually this person, Krishna. So they remain impersonalists. But that is not hardcore Mayavad. That is simply what we call Brahmavad. A person who's still immature in spiritual life and he has not yet gotten a proper dose of Vaishnava association. But Bhagavatam is especially meant for the devotees. Those who want to hear about Krishna, they'll become attracted to him, and their lives will change. And by understanding the transcendental nature of Krishna's birth and activities, they are liberated. They're guaranteed to regain their association with Krishna, their eternal relationship with Krishna. Krishna is still, because he's absolute and infinite, it's hard to comprehend, to understand Krishna. So Krishna's devotees are easier to understand than he is. The gopis are superior to all other living beings. But at least some of them are jivas. Well, maybe not the eight principal gopis, but there are jiva gopis who are also finite living entities. Their footsteps we can follow in. It's possible to also become one of them. You can't become Shakti Tattva. You can't become one of the eight principal gopis, but you can become an assistant of the gopis. Or this, you can enter the cowherd boy community, or become someone in a parental relationship with Krishna, or a cow, or a deer, or something else in Vrindavan. This is available to us. We can actually practice devotional service directly emulating the devotion offered by a particular resident of Vrindavan. This is the practice of Raghunuga Bhakti. So by understanding, it's important to understand the birth and activities of Krishna's devotees, because they are our link. These devotees are guru. In most cases, is not Vishnu Tattva. I think in ISKCON most of our gurus, I don't want to offend anybody's guru, but I think most of the gurus in ISKCON are jivas. And because your guru is a finite living entity, you could have a normal relationship with him. You're not ready to talk to Krishna, but you can talk to your guru. Prabhupada came and talked to the hippies. And they were able, they had access to him. And they became devotees of Krishna by that access. Because by being a finite living entity, the guru makes it easier to approach Krishna. You approach through him, the Vaya medium. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna. Krishna is inconceivable. The Ram Bhaktas prefer to worship Rama because they can understand him. They can't understand Krishna. Krishna is just too unruly. He doesn't obey any immorality. But Ram they can understand. Krishna is not easy to understand. But Krishna came in the form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He presented himself as a finite living entity, as a devotee, making himself accessible the same way that a finite living entity is. He acted like a Bengali Brahmana. Of course, people who have some prejudice against Bengalis, they may have a problem accepting Lord Chaitanya. Some of the Brijvasis are not interested in Lord Chaitanya just because he's Bengali. They just don't like Bengalis. If you can get over that, then Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is very accessible. Even though he's Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, he's appearing and acting like an ordinary living entity. So you, as an ordinary living entity, can establish a relationship with him and with his associates. Srila Prabhupada is one of the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We have connection with him. Maybe we never met him. Maybe we never saw him face to face. The devotee did some paintings. Many devotees did paintings for the Delhi temple. Yeah, it was a big project and a lot of artists were engaged. Some of the second class paintings, the ones that aren't the best, are sitting in the offices, not on public view. Some in the VIP room. There's some paintings, not bad. One painting of Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasana. But it doesn't look exactly right. The reason is that the bottom half of Prabhupada's face is too puffed up. Prabhupada didn't have a fat, his cheeks weren't fat. They weren't too skinny, but they weren't fat, puffed up. And the artist didn't know. That artist never saw Prabhupada face to face. The mistake was made in the painting. It doesn't look exactly right. Still, nonetheless, even those who never saw Prabhupada face to face, who never talked to him, didn't get diksha from him, can have his association. Either directly or indirectly. You can hear from him in his recordings and in his books. And you can associate with him through his disciples and his disciples' disciples. The potency of a pure devotee is not limited like that. That as soon as his physical presence is removed, then you cannot have association with him. A powerful person you can associate with even at a great distance of time and space, even a separation of generations. Look at the sampradayas founded by the great acharyas Ramanuja and Madhva. These founding acharyas are having their influence 1,000 years later, very much in the lives of their devotees. So don't think that Prabhupada's influence won't persist for 1,000 years or 10,000 years. The point is, we can begin to understand Krishna, the transcendental nature of his birth and activities. We can begin to form our relationship with Krishna by practicing on his devotees. The guru is representative of Krishna. By worshipping the guru, by serving the guru, by developing your spiritual relationship with your guru, or gurus plural, and with other devotees, you're learning how to establish a relationship with Krishna. So it's important that these relationships be spiritual. You should not be guru drohi, you should not be guru bogi. Of course, it's spiritual suicide to become hostile to your guru. Unless your guru is nonsense. You should never be hostile to your guru. And even if he is, or becomes nonsense, there's no need for hostility. Guru Droha is never acceptable. A fortunate person may have to leave a guru who is spiritually unfit. That happens sometimes. But there is no injunction, no sanction for becoming inimical to the guru, even in such circumstances. Respect should be maintained. But also, one should not be a guru bogey, trying to exploit the guru for your material purposes. You may not be aware of what you're doing, but you may be just going through the external motions of serving and worshipping the guru because you have a material agenda. He's a powerful person, and you're unconsciously or consciously calculating that you can also become powerful, you know, by osmosis. You know, it's possible, because ISKCON is such a powerful organization. It's holding and transmitting Prabhupada's power. If you become connected with ISKCON, and you become a representative of ISKCON, that makes you powerful. Just by representing Prabhupada, you've got influence. And that can be abused. You can have a materialistic motive. You want power, and you've got your own material agenda. And you use Prabhupada's potency to try to carry out your agenda. That is Guru Boga. Trying to exploit and enjoy the Guru. That also has to be avoided. It's by learning how to be the servant of the Guru that we learn how to serve Krishna. Nobody is going to get away with trying to exploit Krishna. Every person who entered Vrindavan trying to do harm to Krishna was quickly dispatched by Krishna himself. Krishna killed all the demons who tried to enter Vrindavan. So you cannot cheat Krishna. You cannot exploit him. Neither can you get away with exploiting Krishna's devotees. You can do it. You can try it. But you'll simply destroy yourself in the process. So we have to carefully avoid both. You know, we have to develop spiritual relationships, not just with Diksha Guru, but with our god brothers, with all Vaishnavas. The relationships have to be on a spiritual basis. In order to have a proper foundation for a relationship with Krishna. So we're reading about Krishna's relationships with the best devotees in existence, the residents of Vrindavan. Krishna has just taken his birth. He hasn't done anything yet. All he's done is been born and maybe cried. You know, he hasn't displayed much activity yet. But the devotees are now on the scene. They're celebrating his birth. And we should carefully study, as we read these chapters, how Krishna associates with these devotees. It's these devotees who will teach us, ultimately, how to develop our intimate relationship with Krishna. By serving and hearing from and studying the devotees, we learn how to connect ourselves with Krishna. Okay. So any questions or comments? Yes.
Shukadeva Goswami, when he took full devotion, when he got attracted by the pastime of Krishna, he gave up something so valuable that he had the realization of the absolute truth.
Yes.
But regarding the inertia that a person has, otherwise, amongst ordinary cases, well, not like Shukadeva Goswami, but totally, completely ordinary people who are in the modes of nature. So when they take full devotional service, and also the keeping in mind that the jnanis, they want every detail about before surrendering, and that can never be gotten because he is unknowable. How to differentiate that against the shallowness that a person has in giving into anything? Yes, the shallow person would be enticed to do anything.
Well, so the Gyani is very, very hard enough to crack. You know. He has to be convinced a million ways before he'll finally give in. But once you crack that nut, what's inside is very valuable. If you can win a Gyani and make him a devotee, he'll be a very strong devotee. Yeah. Whereas a person who, you know, sentimentally says, yeah, I'm going to become a pure devotee, and thinks that he's given everything up when he hasn't. He joins ISKCON in such a way that he holds on to a lot of things. And he may be wearing saffron, but he's actually, pretty much still materialistic. You know, in some of our Indian, you know, ashrams, there's facility for that. You know, to be a brahmachari and have a bank balance and get a motorcycle and this and that, you know, even when you don't need it. You know, I'm not saying someone can't have a motorcycle for service or even a bank account, but there are some people wearing saffron in ISKCON who don't need these things and are accumulating them. So we sometimes, you know, enter the process of devotional service, but we haven't really surrendered. We're holding on to a lot of material things. And that's, Krishna tolerates it, just to get us into devotional service, but we have to give it up or we won't last. So that person, the person who casually makes a big external show of surrendering, but is still holding on to a lot of things, his situation is precarious. You know, he may not survive. So we have to be real careful. Keep what you need. You know, not everybody can live in a cave or under a tree, and you know, and people have obligations. So we shouldn't artificially renounce more than we can. Hold on to what you need, but don't think you can fool Krishna, remaining a materialist and make a show of being a devotee. You won't last. So yes, the Gyani. Because the Gyani, a real Gyani, is not interested in material things. But he's got some seriously wrong conceptions in his head about the nature of the Absolute. If he can be corrected, if he can crack that nut, then he'll be a very strong devotee. Okay. Yes?
I wish you thank you very much for the wonderful class. There's so many points to touch on. But there's one point that you made me think of was that the impersonalists, you gave such a wonderful explanation of the impersonalists, they believe in the...
I'm breathing into this mic, I'm sorry. That's me.
The impersonalists, they believe in the existence of the Absolute Truth, the Absolute Truth is impersonal, whereas the Buddhists, what's their philosophy? Their philosophy is they don't exist. They don't believe in the existence of the Absolute Truth.
Yes. I guess yes. They're atheists. Although it's not much difference between Buddhism and Advaitavad. Apachanam Bodhamishyate. The philosophy taught by Shankaracharya is pretty much the same as Buddhism. It's just, you know, it's got a thin veneer of theism. So it's... they may have some... the Buddhists say that everything is momentary. This is their basic philosophy. And when you want a more detailed philosophy, then you get a lot of different versions. But the one basic core of Buddhism, the basic core of Buddhist thought, is Kshanakavad. That whatever... not that there's no existence, but what exists doesn't persist from one moment to the next. Everything is only momentary. Which is similar to the philosophy of quantum mechanics, modern physics. That there's just fields of energy. This table is an illusion, according to modern physics. All there are, of course, there are atoms and molecules, but the atoms and molecules are also a fiction. All there are subatomic particles in constant flux. And even those particles are not really anything solid, they're just waves, they're just energies. And according to the uncertainty principle, you can't even say where the energy is. It's not even in a particular place. So it's just constantly changing energy fields. But we think it's a table, and that the table has been here and it will be here next week also. But according to Buddhism, nothing's there from one moment to the next. There are no things, not in the sense that there's absolutely nothing. But there are no things. A thing is something that persists from one moment to the next. It sometimes persists for years or forever. But if there's no persistence, if everything changes from one moment to the next, then there are no things. There is something, but no things. That's basic Buddhism. But then you've got 30, 50 different schools of Buddhism, and they have different explanations of what that means. Some of them are real atheists, some of them are, you know, a little bit theistic. Some of them, you know, they've incorporated all sorts of ideas. But it's hard for them to accept an absolute truth. What do you mean by absolute truth? If the absolute truth is just that wiggling energy, a constantly changing energy, okay, that exists. That's your absolute truth. But there's no Atma, there's no persistent soul. There's no conscious being that exists, you know, individual consciousness that continues to exist from one moment to the next. Consciousness itself is just a phenomena that's constantly changing and it doesn't have any solid basis. There is no persistent soul, conscious being, person.
How do they believe in reincarnation then?
There's an illusion of a self, and there's an illusion of repeated births. It's all... Well, then you can argue, well, whose illusion is it then? Who's having an illusion? There's no person. It's inconsistent. You know, we can easily defeat that view, but that's what they're trying to believe. That somehow there's an appearance of that there are people and that they are conscious, but actually they don't exist. So they don't have any absolute truth that's a thing that exists from one moment to the next. There's no Atma, no soul, and if there's no soul at all, then there's no supreme soul. There's no God. And a Buddhist can't argue about God. They can't tell me what his idea of the nature of God is. Because according to the laws of traditional logic, if you can't use an empty term. You can't tell me what are the qualities of a square triangle. Because the phrase square triangle is absurd. It doesn't refer to anything. So in your Buddhist thought, there is no God. There's no soul. So don't tell me in your Buddhist philosophy about God, about what your idea of God is, because you can't even use the word God in a sentence. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to make a logical proposition about something that, according to your viewpoint, doesn't exist. So, therefore, it's not possible to define a Buddhist concept of the absolute truth, because an absolute truth would have to be a persistent entity. You know, the only kind of absolute truth they could have is just the constantly changing flow of energy.
Thank you.
Okay. Mark, what would you tell me?
But how do they account for the position of Buddha and...
How do they account for the position of Buddha? And the other question is, how do the Mayavadis account for somebody being superior, somebody being junior?
This is just the play of Maya. The Dvaitavadis would explain. I don't know what the Buddhas would say. Buddha's just another, you know, another bundle of energy. Just a perfect one. But I'm a little more familiar with what the Dvaitavadis say. It's the play of Maya. Maya is creating all duality. The law of karma is imposed by Maya. It's imposed on the absolute truth. How that happens, they can't explain. That's inexplicable. How Maya has an effect on the absolute truth and manifests duality imposed upon the absolute truth. But she does it. And she does it by the force of karma. And everybody is born with a karma, good or bad, and suffers results. Like, you know, according to the same way that we describe it. It works of action of the lower karma. But that is created by the power of illusion. And someone is smarter than someone else, more fortunate than someone else because of his karma. But that's just the way that the illusion unravels itself. It's just Maya's play. Inexplicable. They say, don't try to explain how Maya creates duality. Because she creates it. The only thing that exists is the absolute truth, one without a second. Who is this Maya anyway? She's a second. She's something else. Absolute truth, and then there's Maya. So does she exist separately? Does she actually exist? If she does, then the absolute truth is not what it's supposed to be. Here's a second. It's not supposed to be a second. And if she doesn't exist, how does she have any effect on him? So there's all sorts of inconsistencies. But and still, they just say, Maya is inconceivable. You cannot say she exists or doesn't exist. It's unanswerable. And they just leave it at that. And you can't explain what she does and how she creates duality on the top of the non-dual truth. Maya is inexplicable. That's their stand. And this karma is just the creation of Maya and how she does her tricks, nobody knows.
The other thing is, going to the same question, that they accept that somebody's superiority is illusion.
Yes.
And my inferiority is also illusion. And why do they not, you know, dispose of that illusion, say, no, I will not treat you as superior or junior?
Well, to be consistent, they should. Why should they respect their guru? Why should they respect the Vedas? It's all Maya. The Vedas are also Maya. My guru is also Maya. So why should I have any respect for anybody? I'm the absolute truth. What do I need to bow down to anybody else? If they're consistent, they should think like that. But sometimes they do. Yeah.
You have a great mastery of all these different philosophies.
Yes.
I saw in the syllabus of the course, you're saying the six types of Vedic philosophy. We're going to go through that.
In the three-year course, we're sort of limited. We're focusing on the basics. Okay. You know, this is an entry-level program. This three-year course. There's more things that can be studied, especially if you want to do what the BBT is paying us for and become a translator or editor, then that takes more than 3 years of training. And if you want to go on to specialized study, you'd have to specialize after that. You can't expect us to learn everything. But we wanted to have a survey in the third year, maybe not of all six darshans, but of logic, of poetics, which is not one of the darshans, but it's also important. Poetry, something about karma mimamsa. Probably that will be it. We'll have a survey, maybe a quick look at some of the other darshans, and that will fit into the third year. Because the grammar study of Harinam Vyakarana is for 2 years, and then we're done with that. And, then we can look at philosophy in the third year. But it will just be a survey. And then if anybody wants to stick around and go further, they can. We'll probably have a specialized individual program then.
Thank you.
Okay. Dharma.
While describing this, that time doesn't have the same effect on the spiritual world as here, you gave one example that Krishna may, if he wants, he may perform the past again and again, and everyone is forgetting. We gave an example that he kills demons, but sometimes we hear that there are no demons in spiritual life.
Well, I don't know. Siddhartha Goswami makes that statement. There are no in the sixth chapter of the second part of the Brihadbhagavatamrita, that there are no demons are present in Goloka. And then in the next chapter he describes Kamsa coming, taking Krishna to Mathura and Krishna killing Kamsa. And then he kills him, and it happens again and again. So Siddhartha Goswami says no demons, and then the demons come anyway. So I still haven't figured out exactly how to explain that.
Isn't that the
creation
of Yogamaya?
Creation of Yogamaya?
Yeah, to make
life. Well, the things that Yogamaya create, did they exist?
They're existing, but for the reason of the lila.
Okay, but then it's not really, it's not really a demon, it's just a thing? I've heard that it's just cardboard pictures, cardboard statues. Also, that's one suggestion, that there's just images of demons, like a cardboard bolster or something. Everyone thinks it's real. Well, when Krishna, I've heard it, when Krishna goes to Navavrindavan, described in the first